Welcome to Return to Form. We now have a visual element. So those of you listening on podcast services can now go onto our YouTube. And if you would rather see our faces during this special presentation on the London Film Festival, which we have been at, go to our YouTube, Return to Form. YouTube.com/returntoformpod, I believe that's
Something like that, yeah.
Maybe incorrect.
Or a string of incoherent numbers and letters, but something like that.
So we have just been at the London Film Festival, which is a kind of second run festival for Cannes and Venice and to an extent Berlinale, which we were at. So some of the films that we missed, well, we might see, and some of the films that we did talk about, we won't talk about here. But let us begin. How's your festival? Are you enjoying it?
Yeah, this is an important question because this is an experiential event, right? So, I mean, I have... The difference is this is our home city. We are, you know, we've kind of gone to ground where we live. So the vibes are different, I feel. Like the sense of esprit de corps, sense of kind of shared, of being the kind of like court press of film. That feels absent now because, you know, I think part of the reason is down to...
We're just getting on the tube.
Just getting on the tube and like trying to fit it around work. And I think one of the... I don't know, one of the strands that feels kind of like very, very important to me is that we've been cast out of the kingdom of God. We've been sent away from the BFI. So the press and industry screenings are all happening at Picture House Central, which is in Piccadilly Circus, which is like not...
A ghastly interior.
Deeply chuggy cinema, yeah.
Yes, chuggy is the word, a word that I only recently learnt that describes a kind of, I guess, chintzy, crass,
normie,
kitsch,
essentially normie. Very, it's all bar one. It's kind of,
So Picture House Central looks like all bar one. The actual screening rooms at Picture House Central are quite comfortable.
Really nice. Good quite rake, a leg,
decent
soft,
leg room
seats.
For Britain.
Yeah.
That's nice.
But it does feel, it feels like you're slightly apart. And I think one of the, you know, we're not obviously going into like necessarily institutional critique and event critique here, but like there is a sense in which, you know, the way that the BFI have put on LFF does reflect certain kind of, I suppose a certain kind of fly in the ointment of the British film establishment, which is that compared to other festivals, you know, Poland included, it feels Kicino Povera. It feels like we're in, it feels like a sort of bitrate village festival or fate rather
the village
than...
village fate. Is it the Kinks? Is the Kinks playing in the Village Green Preservation
Society?
No,
there's a hurdy-gurdy. There's like a Kinks tribute act called the Winks or the Pinks or something that they're playing. It feels like there's something missing. But I don't want to get too much into weeds about how it's been organized and executed and planned.
Well, there's a token system. That's probably what's giving the village.
It's very tokenistic, very typical of the BFI.
We have, so we can't, we more on that story later. We instead of booking the screenings, we have to go to the delegate's desk half an hour before the screening and collect a little puck, a little yellow or green
like
or red.
Like a kind of poker chip.
That you then hand in at the door of the cinema. But you have to queue up half an hour. I suppose they're banking on cancellations and also their website failing. So they thought they'd create a very analog system.
We've gone back. They've basically been bombed back to the Stone Age by their own inefficiency.
Yes. That is an accurate description of the BFI.
And we've covered the ground of like how it's going down. Like we're not feeling like the vibes yet, but we are. We have begun.
We've seen a lot of films already.
We've kind of immersed ourselves into that kind of the glittering silver light of cinema. We're being, you know, we're glowing.
We are. With that. Yeah. And it's quite a nice day. So, Catherine Breyer is a great director. I think it's fair to say Catherine Breyer.
Supremely good director.
A French director. A woman, but doesn't feel any of the doesn't seem to please feminist film critics much of the time with her kind of pronouncements. A real in a class of her own, I feel. Catherine Breyer, one of my favorite films is En vraie jeune fille, which I'm very glad is being restored at the moment. Coming of age erotic film, yes, because at the moment you can only get it on very dirty, sort of stained DVDs.
There's a ripped version. I saw like a really scuzzy ripped version of it. Yeah, it's good, disgusting. But it
so
needs
4K
like
restoration is coming.
And we've also obviously got Fat Girl, Big Bitch,
Amateur,
as it's been translated into English.
Amateur, to use the French title. And she made various films.
Bluebeard,
which is historical drama. She did Romance X, which is kind of like a sort of kink porno almost.
She's a sex person, basically.
That keeps all of her films, the red thread that runs through all her films is a kind of fixation with the sexual. And last summer, L'été dernier, is no exception.
Nice.
She's now in her 80s.
And hasn't made a film since 2013. So got like a 10-year hiatus. You know, she's jumping back on the horse through various personal travails in her life,
She was hoodwinked. She was conned, and then she made a film about it. Anyway. Yeah.
Which was her last film.
Portrait History of Catherine.
Isabelle Huppert.
Portrait History of the fantastic Catherine Breillat. And her new film, last summer, is a kind of family romance, shall we say. Tell us a bit about this film.
It's a family romance, as it were. Like, so talk about Aaron Burr. But with, it's a golden glossy tale of bourgeois success and contentment and dissatisfaction. Mm-hmm. The narrative really revolves around a bourgeois couple and the wife. So basically the husband has a son from a former marriage. This son, who's been playing out at school, now comes home to roost, basically. Mm-hmm. So his mom doesn't want anything to do with him anymore because he keeps getting kicked out of school. So it's up to dad to look after it. Mm-hmm. So he kind of enters this big palatial lawyery. He's like some sort of unspecified corporate, executive or something. Yeah. So he's a lot of money, and it's very, sort of gorgeous, large house. You know, everything's well oiled.
And she's a kind of girl boss lawyer.
She's a lawyer, yeah. Who deals specifically, and this is very pointed, she deals specifically with abuse, child law.
Yeah, the opening scene is her having a very sensitive conversation with
a young girl
who's been who she is
she's interrogating this young girl, so basically she's
in order that she can adequately defend her against against the defense
the very critical defense that she believes will cast her as a slut and a whore. So what we then get is the introduction of this young boy, this young stud, basically, into the...
he's a sort of curly, floppy-haired indie boy, isn't he?
He really? Is, yeah, but, you know, he's been released amongst horses. And so what we have is the introduction of this young boy, obviously, with all of these... Are we going to spoil it?
We are now. Here we are. In order to talk in any meaningful way about this film, we have to say that it's about a man who fucks his stepmom.
Yeah, it's a guy that basically relives. It's kind of like a Pornhub category. This guy actually shags his mother-in-law, and it deals with the kind of
stepmom. Yeah. Wait, is that the same thing? No, mother-in-law is when you marry someone and the person. And the mother of the person you're marrying.
It's stepmom. So there's not a blood tie there, but there is an ethical boundary, not only because of the age difference. You know, he's 17 or so, and she's
a delicious Freudian dynamic.
So it's kind of the urtypical kind of Oedipal complex, if we want to get into
the urtypical Oedipal.
So we've got urtypical Oedipal complex, and so an erotic, a romantic, and actually a very erotic relationship. You know, this isn't rutting, and one of the things Catherine Breillat is very good at is shining a light on real erotics and
her bedroom scenes are her best scenes.
And that's what we felt when we were watching it. I think that the film has this quality. So the sex scenes and the scenes of kind of flirtation and rizzing and the scenes of like everything from kissing to shagging are executed in this beautifully strange, both tender and very, I suppose, so naturalistic that they become quite surreal way. But the wider like cinematography and the way it's shot elsewhere felt kind of sloppy and second rate
almost
at times.
So pedestrian that you wonder whether it's a stylistic choice. Like, it really looks like an episode of Hollyoaks or something. You remember when when your child and your parents are waiting to watch Channel 4 News and there's some scene of someone throwing wine in someone's face. And it's all very long lens. And
for some of us, that was our real lived upbringing.
True.
Not me though, or you.
It feels really odd, and it's only when about half an hour into the film when this kind of central transgression takes place and you realize that this is going to be the subject of the film that I guess some of that boringness feels kind of almost okay, because you're like, well, you know, what it's lacking in formal transgression, it's certainly making up for in content. It's genuinely
shot with this kind of roving camera that sometimes was a little bit... The rovingness is fine, but I was trying to understand what the roving was establishing. So a film typically like this...
Aimless roving, and weird, washed out colour, like it's like they just didn't expose it correctly.
Exposure was a bit strange. But yeah, and when we get to these sex scenes, suddenly the blocking is really interesting, because I think it's really what Catherine Breyer cares about is sex. The plot, everything else is basically an excuse to get to
And the sex scenes are long. They're like one take usually, take rather than back and forth. I mean, you can't really do back and forth sex because it's next to each other. But you know, there's
the real shot reverse shot.
Maybe that's the reason she didn't do it. Mm. But like, it does have this amazing, this sense of duration suddenly enters the room where it normally doesn't in this film.
Yeah,
which is strange because I think her earlier work, I mean, her best work has a some sense of deliberateness and control. Even in Fat Girl, the most interesting scenes are the sexual scenes.
And it often sometimes shot, there's a slight rovingness to them, but sometimes shot with a kind of static camera. There's something kind of Christian Petzoldian, I should say just Petzoldian, about her earlier cinema.
If you're wondering what the hell do we mean by Christian Petzoldian, we did a whole episode with friend of the show, George Macbeth, on Christian Petzold, the German filmmaker, Karen.
Yeah, there's a similar tendency to treat, sort of charged scenes of a particular kind of fixed frame, or whatever, yada, 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 that might kind of pan a little bit left and right. But with this, the actual blocking of these sex scenes is really interesting. Mm. The first kiss that they share is beautifully weird and seedy, we actually see the kiss very, very close up. Mm-hmm. You know, the camera's right here, and we can kind of glimpse the fact he's watching like some sort of anime on his mobile telephone. And you can kind of see that kind of glimpsing in between their lips. There's the second kiss. So there's interesting mirroring in this film. There's a later kiss, which is much more fraught and intense because he actually falls for this woman. Mm-hmm. He falls for a stepmom because it's not his first sexual encounter, but it might be his first sort of meaningful sexual encounter. And there he's drunk, she's sober, and it's this very desperate, sloppy, wet Frenchie, basically, and it's incredibly well shot.
Yeah.
And there's two sex scenes. The first time we only see his face, really. We see a bit of her hair, and the second time we only see her face. So she's taking quite deliberate aesthetic and compositional strategies she represents.
It's tightly wound with all these like scenes of people not saying things or people trying to stop other people saying things. You know, there's a lot of the film is spent in the sort of legalistic space of what can and can't be said. And you know, it twists and turns in a genuinely exciting and unpredictable way. It does have that. I mean, it would be a good film to compare with Memory by Michel Franco, which we'll talk about hopefully in the next episode, which is also at LFF. But it uses the transgression as a material in a very engaging way.
And finds a kind of interesting novel way to depict it, and also finds a kind of shocking way to represent it, which is like, you know, other filmmakers might choose to represent this transgression purely in an aggressive judgmental and condemning way. And she's removing her judgment from it and actually exploring the tenderness and the passion between these two people, kind of vacuuming out the ethical and legal considerations. The ethical and legal considerations sit around the film. They're the fat on the bone.
Yeah.
You know, those, and we see these, you know, obviously she's a lawyer, there's a duty of care, there's a kind of professional boundary she's crossed. But, you know, Catherine Brett does a great job of just removing those things during the scenes themselves. And they're really tender and quite powerful scenes of erotism and sex that, like, I hate to say things like this, but, you know, no one's really doing it like that. You know, when we saw, you know, Emily Ataf's film last year, which had these really overdone hyperdrive scenes. You know, it dealt with a similar subject matter, which was an age-different sexual relationship. Being kept a secret. But there, she was approaching, it was only, you know, the critique
of young... sentimental and overdone. I think actually maybe this is the secret, at least behind her sex scenes, is this kind of like very bare approach that allows you to kind of fill in the gaps, not with your imagination necessarily, because they're sometimes somewhat explicit, but like they don't overcode what you're watching, which I think is really important with Breyer. And it ultimately leaves you with this, like all good Breyer films, you leave the cinema feeling like you've woken up from a sex dream that you're not sure you should have had. It has a sort of weird, like a cuddling, real sense of unease.
Yeah, it kind of takes, I suppose, the erotic into these interesting places, which is like where it should really exist. It's where they thrive, which is in this the real transgression is, well, the real transgression is not the age difference or the relationship between them. It's actually the kind of way in which that relationship is brought to life and is actually shot, framed, blocked. I think really interesting. So,
but it's only shot, framed, and blocked well
during sex
three times.
Yeah. So put aside the rest of the film, and there's some annoying kind of like bits of like non-diegetic music that kind of slip in, which is a common refrain for us where people just slap a bit of music into a film just to add something, which
it's weirdly normy and then suddenly not normy at all. And I think that's that's actually something you can see in some of Poirot's other work, but it did surprise me that it lacked a certain kind of construction that I expect from her work. Maybe that's symptomatic of where we're at. I think we're going to say this a lot with a lot of the directors we're talking about this festival, is that they're actually making films in a less interesting way than they did 10 years ago in terms of the actual like visual material.
But there's still real worth there, and I still would recommend people to see it, because it's like, you know, not only like Brett completionist, but like, you know, it's an interesting story, and it's like
it's better than Bluebeard, I think. It's definitely like a good definitely good Brett film, a decent Brett film. Moving on, let's do the shorts.
Because my memory has turned to paste over some of these.
I will refresh your memory.
If you run through them, I can kind of I'll see if any neurons fire about these. We watched them in one kind of long clump.
So we got a bit plastered, somewhat more plastered than we are now, watched on the viewing library. Delegates, important delegates like us who've paid our £52, have access to an online library of mostly short films, but some features, including The Brat, weirdly, even though it's quite high profile release, in my opinion, although it might not get distribution, I'm not sure about that. But they have a lot of shorts that are being shown as part of the London Film Festival. The majority of these shorts that we watched were British, and the vast majority of them were funded by BFI Network, which is basically the only way you can get funding in the UK to make a short, and the only way you can really,
like, state institutional funding,
and the only way the only way you, but it's this BFI are the gatekeepers for all almost all that funding, and the only way to make a feature obviously is if you have some kind of track record as a short filmmaker, or as I'm fond of saying, you know, a good British film is only made when someone very eccentric receives a significant inheritance. Park that though. Let's talk about what the BFI believes are the cutting edge of grassroots, homegrown filmmaking talent. We have Mother of Mine. I'm not going to remember the directors of any of these films. It doesn't matter. Mother of Mine, which is a film starring Robert Webb about a man whose wife dies, and then he decides to not tell his daughter. Yep. And there are lots of various pale, desaturated shots of
him. It's extremely miserable. So it's like a kind of creme caramel of a film. So it sort of looks like your nan's sofa from the 70s. It's I found this, I mean, it was pulling a lever, which is miserabilism. It's shot in this kind of like, the house he's in is this kind of miserable London semi-detached. He's got this
Jez
kind of,
from Peep Show. Jez. With less hair. Looking
less
permanently
hair.
Depressed.
And looking like kind of gaunt and a bit faded, because the whole film is kind of gaunt and faded.
But of course, he's just lost his wife. So yeah, sure, he should be sad. But like, it's an insanely manipulative film that gives you no depth or insight into like what the characters are actually
the
feeling.
The real process of grieving, which I don't know what it is, but I think there's lots of things where we have these cutaways to items that she,
she received a boohoo package that she ordered. That it, obviously she's
boohoo
dead.
Indeed,
so
But we get a photo of like a hairbrush with some of her hair on it, and like I don't even like a bathroom items in the toilet, or whatever, and stuff like that. And it's like the camera suddenly switches and gives us these kind of like item shots of these things. And
and no doubt objects
track his eye. Yeah,
objects
kind of
are important in
force.
Storytelling, but it's just so pat and so formulaic.
Chekhov's boohoo package.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But there's let's move on.
Yeah.
There's a film called The Walk, which stars Adil Akhtar, who was
in Four Lions.
He was on Four Lions. Yeah. He played probably the least well-equipped terrorist in Four Lions, Fessel. This is a film about a man. This almost sounds like a joke, the synopsis of this film. A man who has to walk 24 miles a day to get to the job center.
Which, for all the faults of the Conservative administration, I can't imagine that is true in any...
This is crazy.
Yeah.
Anyway, as you'd expect, it's a very, again, like Mother of Mine, it's a very low energy, a miserabilist affair. It is shot in a slightly more exciting
way. The editing
way.
Is a bit more jumpy because it's trying to, because this guy's got like schizophrenia or something, so it's trying to represent the interiority of a character who's going through some sort of form of psychosis. But it has a lot of, it does
is
it in
really?
A sort
of, or is, are they?
Yeah, so it does it in a sort of, there's a sort of like, I'm so crazy. It's like, it's this sort of Joker pilled attempt to represent.
Yeah, and he
psychosis.
Does kind of lose it at the end. Yeah. It's again very manipulative. Making some kind of pathetic, impotent protest at the Conservative government, using money raised by the government, which that would
lost
be
as tools,
which would be fine, I guess, if you. But it just doesn't even say anything interesting. I don't want films in this country to be propaganda. I particularly don't want them to be very, very bad propaganda, which is what.
But it's saying something that we know. Is true that, you know, it sucks to A, have like severe mental health problems, and it's bad to have to walk in theory 24 miles to go to a job center, which might you know, sort of slap you over the wrist for
I would
missed
walk
appointment.
24 miles.
Yeah, that was in my head
just to be at the job center. Yeah, and obviously at the job center he gets completely powered off and ignored, and you know, it's like condensed Ken Loach Daniel Blake bullshit.
Yes, exactly.
Strangers,
it's the kitchen sink, the sort of kitchen sink representing itself again twice. So we've had two kitchen sinks already. We're always
well get ready for more. This one, Strangers, should sort of be seen slightly on its own because it was not funded by the BFI.
No, it was independently funded.
I don't imagine it costs very much. It has quite an arresting opening shot of a sort of dog and then a dog walker entering a field that has electricity pylons. But we are going to launch a bit of a pylon onto this film, I'm afraid, because the acting was quite bad.
Very wooden.
The concept of her walking a dog and the guy, he's lost his dog, and then he tells this sort of story about...
Do you believe me? Do you think I'm telling the truth?
So maybe it's Brexit related.
He's actually Romanian.
He's Romanian, okay.
But he's very German coded, I would say.
Yeah. He's giving German. But he's lost his dog, and then he tells a story about finding the corpse of a young boy in the field. It didn't impress upon us what the hell it was meant to say or do. It after the first shot that I quite liked, it became visually very boring. Shot reverse shot.
And it was also kind of like in this really kind of over, like this really like high contrast. Grayish color that then had this vignette effect around.
Yeah, it almost seemed like an error or something. Oh, there was one wide shot that was clearly just there because they hadn't picked up the dialogue properly. So they just had like this like whenever they presumably didn't have a decent enough shot nearer to the actors, they just had this wide shot where you couldn't see what they were saying. That was just, and then they just played the dialogue. Boring.
It was really bad. It felt like this kind of almost this riddle me this.
Yeah.
Film in a way. It's just like here's like an ethical conundrum. It's like. I don't understand. It was very woodenly written.
So from the very small, bearing in mind these most of these are BFI funded that they're selecting for the BFI London Film Festival. Mm. It's fair to say these BFI funded films won't really get shown anywhere else. So they kind of have to be shown at the London Film Festival. Yeah. So that leaves a very small amount of space for British films that aren't BFI funded in the shorts program. And they've chosen quite a bad film. So that's a shame. There must be, I know there are better short films being made every year than this film. Area Boy, which is about a bunch of young black kids in London, I believe. And there's a sort of
religious conversion narrative.
No, I think that's a different film. No, it's an outcast.
There's so many of these films.
There's a guy who's a bit of an outcast who sort of doesn't seem to fit in. Various scenes of him trying to kind of ingratiate himself on this general crowd of area boys.
And he's super religious. He's kind of like, or he's in, and he's a part of a church.
Oh,
and
yes.
And he's about to have his baptism.
Oh, you're right. Yeah. Oh, yeah, of course, because the end scene of the baptism. But more importantly, suddenly halfway through, you realise he likes putting lipstick on. So there's a trans narrative there. So it doesn't really...
It makes the film
much more
it basically makes the film subservient to the kind of identity politics, and I'm not trying to get over it, Lawrence Fox here, but it makes the film subservient to its
God forbid,
God forbid, of course, but it like makes the film subservient to satisfying or servicing like a particular ideological framework.
Yes, and
so making it not a film is not a film. It is again, you know, as it were, propaganda on a different range, I think.
Yeah, and then right at the end, one of the kids sort of tells him that, you know, tells him in a very roundabout way that it doesn't matter if he wants to experiment or something. So the plot basically hinges on whether this community of black guys are going to accept
this young guy
who
and
has,
a more interesting one is maybe people wouldn't be that understanding, but because the film has to be palatable, of course his mate has to actually, you know, going from a position of being really oppositional to him, suddenly relate to him and, you know, be really understanding. Suddenly,
yeah.
You know, be really understanding, you know, sort of, again, it's servicing a particular kind of, I suppose, liberal fantasy of
like,
you know,
oh, they're good after
this
all.
That's the twist.
The twist is like, you know, you don't have to be racist because actually they're not homophobic.
Yeah.
after all, very just pathetic. Anyone who actually knows about politics would just see this and laugh. Like it's like people who don't know anything about politics attempting to do politics because now everything has to be political.
Political and palatable.
And palatable, yes, and sort of making you think. Most filmmakers you meet, or most people in the industry you meet, think these sorts of films are bad, but they just keep being made because of some kind of strange bureaucratic blockage, I would assume. I don't know.
Yeah.
Clearly someone thinks they're clever. Essex Girls, which is about a young black girl in about 10 years ago, everyone's got Blackberries in school. Mm. And she normally hangs out with these white girls in Essex, where the school is. And the white girls are sort of asking her if she's going to go to the party tonight. And she's like, oh, I'm not sure. And they're like, oh, Mark really likes you. Oh, I'm not sure. I don't know if he's called Mark. But anyway, there's a guy that she doesn't think that this white guy likes him because she's black. Then during an incident of extreme racism from the balding geography teacher.
Very pointed, over-exaggerated racism.
He says, he's like, explains, like, so basically none of the kids are really paying much attention. And then he says, we're talking about migration, which is why you lot came over here.
It's like, who knows what migration is?
So yes, the white working class don't get a good rap in this. But yeah, so it's just there's a fish out of water element. These two black girls sort of both call this out, both notice this form of racism. The teacher both stick up for themselves and are punished for it. And in their moment of punishment, the detention or whatever, they then bond. And at the last minute, she's supposed to go out with the white people on a Friday night. She decides to go to London with her black friend and meets loads of a party full of black people. And there's a very handsome black guy who seduces her. Then they change her hairstyle and she like loves her new hairstyle. And then like the next
thing. Even though she's a literal schoolgirl, can we point out that little bit of narrative? He looks like a strapping young man.
Is age gap. Discourse on discourse here. Back. You know, because you've got to be
but it
absolutely.
It doesn't problematize that. No. I mean, you know, this is, I suppose, these are not films again. These are exercises in satisfying a particular kind of expression of the liberal imagination. Nothing more than that.
Absolutely.
There was very little, particularly with that film, like Area Boy, though it was competently, like the cinematography was quite competent and, you know, it was solidly shot like a good quality sort of, you know, BBC drama or something, maybe better than that. Whereas Essex Girls was shot very indifferently.
I think what most upset me about Essex Girl was just the fact that its central premise was like stick to your own. Its central premise
is segregation.
Like, yeah, they're like, yeah, like yeah. You'll never be understood by someone of a different race. So you should just. I don't think I'm being too extreme in saying that was obviously people of different experiences.
That was the takeaway.
Yeah, obviously people of different experiences are going to bond. You know, going to have different things to bond over. But it was certain, maybe just because it was a short film. I don't know, but it didn't explore any other complexities or contradictions in the bonding. It was just very basically like she should be hanging out with people who look like her or who have experienced racism in the same way that she has. So and again, and you know, it's not not really a learning experience for anyone, and it's not film.
It's not filmy. This thing we often talk about, and we often invoke the nature of it. It's like truthiness. This is filminess, and there is a certain filminess to film, which is something that tells a story by sort of bootstrapping narrative and the formal qualities of film together. You know, the best films do that. They they are a visual medium. This is exactly. Where someone like Shlovsky is really incorrect, because Shlovsky was like, you know, he said that film had superseded literature by, you know, basically doing literature better. And it's like, that's not true at all. It's a very distinct, unique medium that exists in its own right. I think it's frustrating to see, I suppose, funding is a bit of fruit here, I suppose, but we're seeing, you know, funding go towards films that seem most indifferent about it. It's just a story that happens to be caught on camera.
Yeah.
And that's not a film. That is not a film. You know, that is just a story. That is just a, you know, an ideological point. If these films took kind of, I suppose, more daring, formal, you know, how can you tell a story? How do you know, it's really basic media study stuff. Mm. You know, how do you communicate a character's isolation or alienation? Mm. Maybe shoot them from a wider distance, you know, maybe frame it differently, maybe take different formal strategies to approach that story. But none of that is just shot like any old, they're shot like any old.
None of that is
Netflix
really noticeable.
Drama.
When they do something unusual, it's usually very traditional in terms of the mise-en-scene. Two more horrendous short films to discuss.
I can't even remember them.
South Facing, which is about a young black girl in London whose mother's rice and peas Caribbean food business was shut down because of a trendy flat white third wave coffee place. And she decides to, and this the person running the third wave sort of like forced her out of business with lots
and
of,
she's a bit of a bitch,
and so she's a bit of a bitch.
It's a confrontation.
It's a confrontation. She pretend her and her boyfriend pretend to be documentary makers and interview this horrible white woman who's just a total bitch and confront her on her being a total bitch, and then she's kind of a bitch to them. And then they go home to the protagonist's mum, who is just extremely generous about the whole thing and says, this isn't the way to, you know, thank you.
This is a moral lesson. It's just, you know.
So once again, there are good people and there are bad people, and we won't learn anything else about them. And that...
very binary. It's extremely binary.
That goodness and badness, the way it's arranged, will satisfy... Mm-hmm.
It was well acted. I thought that was well acted, that film, actually, in fairness to it.
Yeah.
The two kids were like really good in it, I thought. But.
And then the last film, which I'm proud to say. Why am I proud to say it?
I'm proud to say it.
It was the worst.
Are we counting this amongst, are we talking about?
We're talking about, no, we're talking about The Singer. You forgot about The Singer, the Glaswegian busker film.
Oh my God,
deaf guy.
Yes.
This is so incredible.
Okay, yeah. I feel like this, so there's something about The Singer. So this was actually funded by...
Screen Scotland, right?
Screen Scotcheg or whatever it is. Yeah, like the BFI.
Short Circuit,
that's it.
The Scottish equivalent of the BFI. Quite dark, should we get a light on?
We're talking earlier about the problems of overexposure. Now we're talking about problems of underexposing a scene. Here we go, that's better. So the kindest thing I can say about this is it would have made a great Vodafone advert. You know, these kind of, again, very together...
Connection is important.
Yeah. You know, it's about a sort of slightly mopey, sad boy busker.
Yeah.
And a in Glasgow, and a which is bad enough. You know, he's sad, but he's also in Glasgow. And there's also a deaf guy who loves music, and they connect over music. And there's a kind of, you know, this deaf guy's a bit, you know, kind of strange, and he's a bit of a weirdo, right?
Yeah, it starts off with the busker being
robbed. Actually, he's
robbed in the street. Yes,
good.
because his music is awful and horrible to listen to. That doesn't mean he deserves to be robbed, but it was very bad music, and someone plays a cruel trick on him. And then the deaf guy tries to sort of intervene, is misunderstood as also being part of the mob, and then they kind of form this unlikely bond. Mm. And obviously he expresses his love for the music in a different kind of way than someone who has perfect hearing. But it just bangs on and on and on for 19 minutes in the most ugly way. I mean, you can just see like loads of adverts in the background of the shots. It just has no sense of like isolating things to look nicer.
The blocking, the actual composition and blocking is so indifferent.
So horrible and ugly. The characters are just you know, they are being pitied in the form of the film. That they are the subject of pity, not intrigue.
Mm. There's no real ambiguity
about
this.
I think
there was something
just pathetic.
The actual music itself that they bond over was terrible. Like these drawly. It's like the kind of music they play in a Starbucks at Christmas. These songs that they're kind of uniting over. It was they go home to the deaf guy's flat.
Yes.
And end up like bonding over. He can feel the reverberations of the music through his feet. Yeah.
But they don't even have gay sex. They don't even have like a.
It does set it up for
there's
that.
Not even
it?
A romantic. There's a suggestion of a romantic connection, but it doesn't even.
No, it's just friendship.
They just sort of like hang out and like console and each other somehow. But then he like leaves. In the morning before he
because he's woken up in some strange guy's flat.
Yeah,
like, get the fuck out.
And then like they do it, and then he's like a bit awkward when the deaf guy returns. But then they do this like duet, and they're like friends again. I mean, who is watching these films and thinking, especially this film, which was particularly bad? Who is watching these films and thinking, oh, that's so true? Like, these people have worms for brains. This film was disgusting. This film was disgustingly sentimental. It was visually ugly, and it told me nothing. And it looks like an advert. It literally looked like an advert. It also had the truth content of an advert. It was.
Yeah, it had this very commercial kind of like. It was so boiled down to its selling its message that it ended up just selling something. It was selling nothing in the process because it was constructed.
They
like
could
an
have
advert.
Made some money. Vodafone could have paid for it, and it might have made the people involved a bit more money.
I mean, yeah. Again, it was just a pure exercise. It felt like a kind of didactic exercise. It was a very deeply didactic exercise in about understanding through difference and friendship and coming together. But again. That is not a film. Mm. You know, that's an instructional video. I expect that from a sort of local authorities video about how to take out the correct recycling bins. You know, that's what it was. That was the register of this film. And this is surely...
Yeah, it doesn't work. It preaches to the converted. Anyone who finds this
No
film
one's watching this and going, oh my God, actually, yeah, deaf people are people.
I just realized I should be nice to deaf people and I shouldn't like... assault and rob buskers in the street. BFI for showing me
maybe
that.
The people of Scotland do need to hear these messages. I don't know. I'm not sure.
But
it was really laughable.
To conclude. We've run the gamut of some pretty horrendous short films. And these films are supposed to be
pick of the crop.
The pick of the crop in some sense. They have been selected, at least at the funding stage. And it's a crying shame. And anyone in the film industry knows someone who's applied for this sort of money and not got it.
Yeah, our hands are extended.
And exactly like the busker.
Like the busker. And yeah, we've been mugged by the BFI.
Yeah. Maybe because of the Conservative government, a small pot or whatever. But
I think it's a small pot and increasingly shrinking pot.
A small and increasingly shrinking pot being increasingly poorly apportioned.
But we should, now move on to. I want to say better things. We are moving on to better things in some senses, but we have to kind of dodge through the narrows of something that's a little bit less high quality, which is we have to go through.
Ha.
To bring this back, we watched Haar, which is a British sort of somewhere between a short and a feature film, sort of 80 minutes long film starring Kate Reynolds.
I can't remember the name of the actors. Yeah.
So basically, this film concerns a sort of unit production manager. This is another film about someone involved in the film industry. Yeah.
Write about what you know.
Yeah, it was sort of temporarily stranded in Budapest due to a closed airport.
Because of COVID? No, closed
no,
airport.
No, some other issue that's kind of not explained. And during this kind of stay, she receives some sort of tragic news about the death of her father, and also has a series of kind of like ambiguous encounters with people who are new and people who she doesn't know. And the crucial thing, the difference is on the kind of like the Mark Jenkin effect is that it's shot on Super 8. It's shot on Kodak Super 8 films. So it's my concern always with the, I guess, aesthetic decision to and a formal decision to shoot in film. Mm-hmm. Now, there's a lot that has been done with film historically, like most film that has been shot or sort of like most of the years in which film has been shot was shot on film, varying qualities of varying registers and everything from the Lumiere Cinecam up to, like 35 millimeter. It is you're making a particular kind of decision. You're making a particular statement by choosing to shoot on Super 8, which is a lightweight handheld format, which is capable, as actually Mark Jenkin does, acknowledge and express, is capable of being exposed interestingly, yeah. is capable of being pushed to interesting places in terms of lens
more,
flare.
And exactly. It's more vulnerable to sort of light leaks and scratches. Yeah. I mean, generally, the lower the gauge of film, the more it looks like film, like the more it's unavoidably.
So Super 8, you're filmiest. And the thing was, this is shot in such lustrous Kodak and in such a kind of normative way on tripod, often just panning around, that any benefits that might have accrued from shooting on film were lost, because what you've really got is you've got a digital film that looks like it's had a kind of film filter effect put over the top.
Yeah,
it felt like it nullified itself.
It doesn't justify itself.
No, it doesn't.
And this technique is more or less the same technique that you get in Mark Jenkins' Bait, which, for all the rude things we say about Mark Jenkins, I think was quite a good film, and a kind of a very exciting debut.
A very good film.
And yes, it uses this technique of putting the sound in afterwards, but it absolutely.
But he shoots in kind of this quite high contrast black and white. He shoots with like. Real depth. So, you know, for Mark Jenkins, the kind of, as it were, the silent partner of that film is the sea, because it's shot on the coast, and the sea is always something we should see in Bait, in this kind of washy Jean Epstein style blur in the distance. It's really kind of enthralling and kind of sublime in a way. Whereas this, you're not really getting it, because it just looks like a sort of like nice picture postcard of Budapest. Most of it's shot kind of medium and sometimes in close up.
Who's this guy, Ben Hecking? So he seems
he's a DOP.
He's a DOP, and but he has directed
shooting films.
He has directed a few sort of video on demand rom coms, it seems.
Something like that.
But yes, it feels a bit like a kind of film made between other films, a kind of passion project. You know, it doesn't, unlike the film we were just talking about, it doesn't look like a Vodafone advert.
And yet there are phones in it,
and that there are quite sort of funny sort of super 8 shots of people using iPhones. But yes, it has a thanks to Joanna Hogg at the end. So it's from a certain stable, I would imagine. Although it has none of the skill of Joanna Hogg's work.
It was like a perfectly fine. It was finely written, and I think Kate Reynolds is very good in the role as this kind of protagonist who's going through this, you know, sort of personal trauma. There's a very sexy scene, I suppose, which is, you know, throughout she acts very competently and interestingly, but I think it does a disservice to itself by having this ADR. It does a disservice to itself by choosing to shoot in film, which ends up being a distraction from, and it basically gives it an out on having to make any formal interesting compositional decisions, because it's saying, oh, well, it's in film, so it's interesting formally. And it's not interesting because it's shot in film, because it didn't need that. It felt like.
But the thing is,
it's such an agile format to shoot in. This is a tiny camera that's about this big, weighs about less than a bag of sugar, right? And it's like, you know, it's something that Jonas Mekas used. You know, Jonas Mekas would dance with his camera. You know, this is something that's so super supple, and it's super, pliable to. You know, capture footage, to skip frames, to jump, to jolt, to, particularly when the film is really about this woman's interiority and her feeling like she's kind of acting weird around various people that she has
her
to
her interiority
interact with.
Is entirely unexplored, and it may not be the actor's fault, but it does absolutely lack any kind of.
The film is just interested in like these comedy of manners, like, you know, no one knows that her dad's just died, so she's acting kind of weird at a party, and then she's a bit distant when she meets a former colleague, and someone's a bit nice to her and gives her a sandwich. So we see these kind of external, these exterior kind of expressions of interiority. But the point with something like Super 8 is that's the instrument to explore the strange perspectival distortions.
But you're also, not really taken on a journey. I mean, every scene is just so flat. But I do want to say about this Super 8 thing. I mean, why did we even watch this film, right? Because it was shot on Super 8. Because it's sort of in the program, amidst a long line of other, we get emails as delegates. We receive emails every day from desperate producers and sales agents saying, you know, you must come and see this film, and
you can really make a difference.
It's invariably, almost by definition, not a film we actually are seeking out, because it's not by an established director. And so, they're saying, they're sort of trying to entice us with, you know, maybe a minor star or whatever. and or trying to ask if we want to interview the director, you know, and these are not personalized messages. They don't know who we are either. Mm. This is a mutual lack of...
a veil of ignorance.
Excitement. Yeah. But yes, regrettably, our emails have been added to some list and we hear about all these films. And this was the only film that we are reviewing that we also were kind of...
Neophytes too. This was unknown to
that
us.
That we were actually kind of... That exists within that category of LFF film that just is like being like hopelessly hawked. And yeah, it is, and it stood out to us. Why? Because I suppose because it's British and we sort of want to see what a low budget British indie feature looks like, and also because it's this 16 mil has this quality in the industry of marking something out, making people think, oh, it might actually look kind of interesting or be kind of interesting. Sadly not. And also weirdly, they seem to have spent the whole budget on like quite expensive music choices. It starts with Future Islands. I mean, maybe this person just has a deal or they're just winging it, but weird like bad aesthetically to
very
start
programmatic
with that song.
Well, when your whole point of your film is to have these kind of this separation between the lived reality of what is shot and this ADR'd music, to then have this other, it's unintentionally alienating to then just pump in a bit of, you know, it's very Channel 4 drama in a way. It's sort of, we'll just drop in a bit of kind of vibey millennial music to kind of set the scene. It felt unconsidered. Mm-hmm. You know, it didn't need that music. It was, I think, any opportunity to estrange the experience. And she's going through a deeply, you know, as it were, once in a lifetime experience, which is, a parent dying. More than once in a lifetime, twice in a lifetime, maybe. But you know what I mean? It's a very extremely uncommon experience. Mm-hmm. Lots of, you know, she's put in situations where the opportunities for estrangement are presented, but we only really get that level of the script, which is her acting a bit weird around people. Even when she kind of spins out a bit, the camera really doesn't do anything differently. It just kind of, there's a few cuts and the editing kind of paces up. So we get a few slices into the shot and we see her from a few different angles, whereas the rest of the time it's been a little bit shot, reverse shot.
Would have actually been a decent short, maybe.
I think it feels like a short that was padded, because at the end we get these two very over-mannerized monologues by these characters. She has this understanding with this guy, and she talks about her dead dad and he talks about him being a bit of a shit dad to his young daughter. But these monologues felt so manicured and preened to sound deep and meaningful and, you know, kind of like... street wisdom in a way, but it just felt, and they occupied the last 20 minutes of this film, so it did feel like a much shorter film that was then, you know, sort of
it's really pushing that 80 minute mark on. It feels like got over the line.
I didn't love it. I thought Kate Reynolds' performance was really good. I just didn't feel that the film was justified, and when you make a film in this format, it's really jumping up and down going, hey, I'm shot in this technique. And so do something with it, do something interesting with it. You know, surprising that, you know, he's allegedly a cinematographer, a DOP, because it didn't feel like the hand of a DOP behind it, apart from the technical, you know how. I'm sure there's a lot of technical know-how how to use this ably in the field, but it was too pristine.
It wasn't Greg Toland. You know, it had no compositional flair whatsoever. Mm.
It was basically like using a sort of, it's like using a hacksaw to carve an ice sculpture, right? It's uninteresting, you know.
Crude.
You know, so, I mean, this thing, because the, you know, what the result is something that just looks very nice. And like I said, it looks like someone's just stuck an Adobe filter, like old film but effect, you know, filter it over a digital film.
It doesn't look nice in any way other than the fact that Super 8 looks nice. And it's not actually, we're now discovering... After the heady excitement of the BFI film on Film Festival, which we love, we are also discovering that it's not enough. You can't just shot stuff on film. You actually have to
do something.
I mean, it just seems like an obvious thing to say, but you actually have to shoot an interesting shot, and the characters have to like have like rich interior worlds. Speaking of interior worlds, I am now going to review Priscilla,
which I did not see,
by Sofia Coppola, which feels like an important film to review.
Real Nepo baby hours.
Yeah, well, I think she sort of transcended Nepo.
That's a joke. Nepo. She's a great director. Always historically been a great director.
This film, unfortunately, did not excite me at all. It is a kind of endorsed by Priscilla Presley. She's the executive producer. It is a film about the gilded cage scenario that Priscilla Presley found herself in early on in life. It wanders around various pontifications around grooming, I guess, because she was sort of selected out of a crowd by Presley in West Germany while he was on military service. And Jacob Elordi plays Elvis very unconvincingly. Someone I saw it with afterwards said that, like Austin Butler in Baz Luhrmann's recent Elvis, he simply was too skinny to play Elvis, which I thought was interesting.
Yeah, it was always a bit of a fat suit.
Yeah, yeah, you should have leaned into that a bit more. Mm. But whatever it is, I mean, the paradox of this is you don't want to make a film about Elvis. You want to make a film about the person who was kind of like entranced by Elvis. And yet, in order to make that film, you actually have to make Elvis entrancing. You have to sort of see what she sees.
The magnetism.
And you do see quite a lot of him. You actually see more of him than I think the film should probably show, given that it's about someone who spent a lot of time not with the person they were in love with. I mean, he goes on these various jaunts.
Well, the daring film shoots doesn't happen at all. You know,
well, that Priscilla could be film, interesting. Yeah, yeah. Priscilla just Jean Dielmaning at home basically would be more interesting. This is made further like ridiculous by this ridiculous scene, this absurd liberal sop at the end where she's finally decided to leave Graceland and she greets, she says farewell to the help, an old elderly black servant and the grandmother of Elvis, who's also kind of basically a servant, and another woman who's just like a secretary or something. And she sort of gives them a warm hug and it's like, oh, these ladies understand the labor, the emotional labor. Mm. And it's like, well, you never talk to these women. I mean, there's no, apart from the occasional knowing glance, you know, you must have spent an awful lot of time talking to these women, but the script didn't.
But they're not forwarded. They're just kind of instrumentalized at the end.
Exactly.
This kind of gracious, let them eat cake.
Exactly. Good callback to Marie Antoinette.
Thank you, that was intentional. But the thing is, like I said when I was talking to you, I mean, I didn't see Priscilla, but you know, there was a moment at the turn of the millennium when Sofia Coppola has this glorious triple jump of films.
Yes.
You know, including Virgin Suicides and so on, which were Lost in Translation. And she was...
genuinely weird subject of films.
Strange subject.
Like unsettling.
Ambivalent.
This isn't weird, this
and,
film.
Yeah, ambiguous, but also really, really, really kind of pissed on the third rail of the zeitgeist. You know, these films kind of embodied a particular kind of, they were like pre-amplification for nostalgia at a time when the nostalgia hadn't yet arrived for that period. They kind of define that transition into the new millennium really interestingly, and Marie Antoinette included, in their own way. They were all sexy and strange and unusual and had interesting subject matter and explored kind of power dynamics in interesting ways. So yeah, it's kind of a shame to then kind of retreat into the safe cocoon of like an easy to tell biopic, you know, which is obviously, Priscilla Presley probably had a bit of a shit time.
And unfortunately,
Elvis was magnetic and a bit of an asshole. That's so obvious.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, that's not that. You know, I'm hearing this for the first time.
Exactly, and unfortunately, it probably by dint of it being kind of sponsored, or executive produced rather by its subject, it doesn't really give its central character much in the way of like contradiction or complexity. Not that I would like it to be some kind of victim blaming thing, but I mean, there's got to be more going on there than what we see in, albeit a very capable and compelling central performance from Kaylee Spaney. But essentially the script doesn't really give her much room to move, other than, you know, she fancies this really famous charismatic guy who actually isn't charismatic in the film.
I feel like...
Crisis of IP. It's a Crisis of IP film. It's a film about something you already know about that you'll go and
we
see.
We know very recently because Baz Luhrmann made an odd biopic of Elvis not that long ago, literally just last year or the year before last, you know, which was inhabiting the idea of the excessiveness of pop was actually a great film. I thought it was really good.
You know, haven't seen it, but yeah.
I thought it was excellent. You know,
take your word for it.
Maybe... I don't know if it's Baz Luhrmann's best, maybe it is. It was just, it inhabited the kind of strange hypnagogic space of stardom and the effect of stardom in a really interesting way. Editorially, I thought I really liked it.
I probably won't watch it, but...
No, you probably won't, I think you'd prefer.
I
think
I would like, definitely,
I think if it was like an even race between the two, I think you would, you would see a lot more meat on the bones.
There was very little to like about Priscilla.
Yeah.
But it passed the time.
Just passed the time.
Just about, I mean, it didn't pass the time. I was like waiting for it to end. But anyway, Monster. Should we talk about everybody knows I'm a motherfucking monster?
Monster. What's that coming over the hill? It's Monster.
Coriada's new film.
Hirozuki Coriada. Monster. So Monster is, you know, following on from, you know, last year's Broker. You know, the thing is Coriada is really like the big daddy of sentimental filmmaking. He makes often very beguiling, very beautiful, sentimental films, have often quite tidy, they explore, you know, ambiguous subject matter, but tend to have tidy endings. You know, mm-hmm. That's his thing. He stock in trade. He does it very well. You know, but they leave, you know, can leave something to be desired. There's not something quite right about them. They're quite manipulative and programmatic. Mm-hmm. Monster is an exploration of bullying. Mm-hmm. Of shame and guilt and power, mm-hmm. And all of these things. So it centers on a narrative around a young boy in a school with a single mum raising him, and this young boy has a friend at the school, and this young boy is accused of bullying this other guy, and their class teacher, Mr. Hiro. I misread Hirohito. It's not, it's Hiro. Hiro. So Mr. Hiro is accused of
HIRO
is accused of sort of like abusing or bullying the young kid, and it kind of explores the ramifications of this.
And there's quite an amazing Kafkaesque scene where the mother, very understandably perturbed by her son's recent odd behavior,
it's very defensive.
Goes and meets the head teacher, who has this strange robotic quality in the way that she
reverts the script.
Yeah, in the way that she responds to the pleas of the mother. But basically, in the opening, you're really none the wiser as to whose fault it is, but you have a few clues, which then in these subsequent retellings of the story,
sort of three
we
narratives.
Get different accounts. Yeah. And it's not quite Rashomon where they are completely biased. They're all revealed to be biased accounts that tell a different, you know, different chain of events.
At the end of Rashomon, there is no authoritative account. Of
whereas
happens,
these films are, they're not even from particular perspectives, but they sort of concertina between
they, different, from different segments
but
of
they
time.
Open,
they show us different
moments,
corrugations of time.
Exactly. Yeah. And they kind of illuminate different bits of the story so that you kind of have a better idea once you've watched all three of them what happened. But to me, it felt a bit cheap because it was like, it felt like I was being kind of purposefully, for the fun of it, I was just having like information about what was happening withdrawn and then shown to me in an inconvenient or an unreasonable time. Why did I have to wait like 40 minutes to find out that something else actually happened afterwards that recontextualizes the thing I just saw, but in this second iteration of how the story is told, just so that I can go, that's interesting.
It's a highly faceted narrative in a lot of ways. So it's, you know, this is a buzzword at the moment, but it's highly baroque in terms of its structure. It reveals itself as a kind of polyvocal film later on. It's sort of surprising to suddenly get
this. Yes, it does the first
this.
Run of the story, and then it just restarts. It starts with this massive building that has a strip club in it on fire.
Mm. I thought it was great, the evocation.
Yeah, that bit's pretty good.
It really is quite
sublime.
And
then it goes again with the fire. Like, so you know the story's resetting when you see the fire, the building on fire again.
Yeah, and I think so, at times it was very sublime in its framing and composition, very beautiful. You know, it has, you know, Coriada has a real sensitiveness to these kind of excisions or these fragments of scenes that he pulls away in the way that Bresson would shoot a hand or a gesture. Coriada can be very good at alighting on a detail that might feel isn't necessarily narratively momentous, but he'll pull away and reflect on some leaves blowing on the ground, or he'll reflect on a drop of blood falling from somebody's nose. Decision to leave. Actually it was not that dissimilar from the kind of fractured narrative structure, compositional structure of Decision to Leave by Park Chan-wook. But yeah, so we get these, he's got this great eye for these moments of sublime focus on particular things that aren't necessarily narratively important. They're just kind of emotively resonant. They're like little tuning forks that he scatters throughout the film. He's very good at that. So it looks nice, and it had beautiful sound design. But I think my problem with it, it felt quite emotionally manipulative.
Right.
It felt very synthetically tidy, because at the end it wanted us to know that actually the two boys are actually really good friends by the end, and everyone's happy, and the teachers, his reputation's kind of been saved a bit.
I spoke to someone in the foyer who interpreted that as them dying and then going to heaven, but
that's bullshit.
That doesn't seem true at all. I dissuaded this woman of her delusion.
Completely incorrect. Yeah, you know, wrong.
Sometimes I'm wrong about plots, so I
don't know. No, I think that's the wrong thing. I think there's this kind of rebirth moment because there's a big storm, basically, and they get out of the storm. That's it. It's just a storm. It's just this pathetic moment of pathetic fallacy.
I mean, he is good at pathetic fallacy generally. I mean, the moment, or just like metaphors that make you feel stuff. There is this moment where he I don't like so much, that he's in this like Lucas Daunt close way, kind of like confesses his like boy on boy love.
There's a sort of nasty and adolescent sexy thing between them,
Just romantic, really.
Romantic, that's it,
not even erotic, really, just like they love being together. And then she's like, if you have a feeling, blow it away. And she reveals that she's her teacher, who has hitherto been a very cold and icy woman. And we learn has maybe like accidentally run over her child, but her husband's taking the rap for it. Very interesting. But she basically says, oh, you know, if you have a difficult feeling, like blow it away, like blow it into the trumpet. And then she like teaches him how to play trombone or trumpet or something. And then they make these haunting discordant noises that sound a bit like maybe Mika Levy suddenly taken over the soundtrack. And it's much better than all the sentimental Ryuichi Sakamoto.
It is literally Ryuichi Sakamoto. I wonder if it was one of his last acts before he died was to make this.
I mean, maybe he also was in charge of that composition.
I think he must have been in charge of the whole composition because that feels like that.
But it's
that,
so different from the plinky plonky sentimental.
Yeah, because we get other parts
to feel sad now. Music.
Yeah, we get other parts of the film where someone's reflecting and they feel bad, so we get this kind of uplifting of ding 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 ding. We get the piano coming, and it's like, let the actor and the composition give me that. You know. That don't, you know, it's too programmatic. It's shoving you. It's going, oh, this is sad. And you're supposed to be feeling something right now.
But look, Broker was good. I mean, but it's funny you say this about.
I found this better, if only because the stakes are more interesting, because the experience of, like, you know, when you're a child or an adolescent, you go through these experiences, which you gradually, your emotional life world and your ethical life world is expanding as you grow, and you encounter situations which are complicated and difficult, and you don't know how to do it. So kids often go silent, or they lie, or they hide, and it can be very difficult for parents and very stressful for parents, I imagine, to kind of unpick the truth.
It all started well, illuminating
exploring that. Ambiguities in the school setting. And I think there's an amazing scene, actually, and it's a very good satire at times as well, about politeness and saving face, about, you know, when the mum goes to confront the school board very hysterically, and in a, I suppose, properly Japanese way, they kind of close ranks and act very deferential.
She's not being hysterical. I mean, I suppose
in the context of Japanese, you know, sort of reserve and politeness, she is, and she's kind of overstepping, and the blocking in that scene is fantastic, because they're all bowing to her, and we see her face kind of through these bowed bodies. It's very tight, it's very close.
But this isn't just a Japanese culture thing. They are meant to seem like icy, right?
Yeah, they're supposed to seem excessively icy and unapologetic, you know, because they're kind of, there's reasons why they don't want to accuse her son of bullying. And there's reasons they don't want to admit that maybe something's not going up well with the teaching at the school, because they don't want to basically get told off by the big school board, basically. So they're kind of, you know, protecting their own. And so it's very good at, like, I thought that the actual kind of stakes and the kind of raw meat of the film is quite an interesting space. And it's something we saw with, you know, Lucas Daunt's Close was quite good at exploring those kind of the ambivalence and strangeness of adolescence. And it's something Laura Waddell did even better with Playground, which I think is the best version of this film, because we're seeing a lot of dementia films at the moment. We're seeing a lot of bullying and childhood films at the moment. We're getting these two things. We're not getting so much middle life. We're getting a lot of youth, and we're getting a lot of
polarization. You know, that's what they say about porn. You know, it's all about the MILFs and the teens.
Yeah.
We're not getting anything in between.
But I think this is it. And I think there was something about, you know, I think Laura Waddell with Playground did it particularly well, because formally it was the most interesting, because it was shot entirely from a children's perspective. It was really ambiguous. It was painful. You felt the pain of these children. This film was very, it wanted to have a neatly tied, wrapped bow at the end of the film and to kind of say, oh, everything's kind of all right. And that was that's Corrieta's thing. I just don't think it makes for great cinema. I think if a great cinema is allowing that to hang in the air.
And it's weird as well that his career, you know, I watched Afterlife, which I had never seen before. His,
really good film.
Second feature film. And I had seen Marlborosi, and I remember that being quite like a bit like not as conventional as these recent films. Although this has an unconventional narrative structure, it's shot and kind of played out in a fairly conventional way. And yeah, I just thought, wow, Afterlife is such an extraordinary novel device.
Mm.
It's like deeply weird, but
has
like
a kind of Nathan Fielder-y
It's basically a proto Nathan Fielder, Afterlife by Corrieta. You definitely watch it if you haven't. Yeah, it's weird that he sort of doesn't really do stuff like that anymore. Broker I really liked as a kind of like conventionally shot thoughtful narrative that I would have thought could do as well as Parasite. Of course it didn't.
It was,
you know, I was very happy with that film, but I'm glad he was more bold in some ways with this film, but it didn't come off. So yeah,
I think it will distribute in the UK, I can imagine.
Yeah, Picture House, so that'll be fine. Yeah. But
I think people will see it. It's good. Like honestly, like it's still very beautiful and often quite sublime and quite ambiguous. I think it just fails to realise the real emotional ambiguities and resonances of what of the topic is exploring. It's too deferential ultimately to niceness and to narrative cohesion at the end, whereas I think it could have been a lot more strange and thorny.
Yeah, and the moments when it was strange and thorny like proved that, I think.
He can do it. He can go there. He just won't, because he's like I said at the beginning, you know, this is his stock in trade really now, is doing neatly tied packages. But if you I said this before, we went to see it, it's all, Corrieta is always like now a kind of nice belly rub in a film festival. Like it's quite pleasant to watch. Like
it'll be 2 hours. Yeah. It'll have some humanity to it. And you know, you'll
so it's very cute.
If you want to, you can feel something.
Yeah. If you want.
Speaking of sublimity, we have one more film to discuss, which we just saw today.
It's fresh.
It was a very long film. It was 3 hours and 2 minutes, I believe. Inside the Yellow Cocoon Shell by...
Tien An, but I can't remember his first name.
Okay.
Tien An is his surname. His debut film by a guy who's I believe a graphic novelist and now filmmaker. What's his first name? Don't embarrass me. It's Tien An.
Pham Tien An.
Pham. Yeah, Pham.
Yeah, right. What are you saying, fam?
What's it, fam?
It's PH is fam.
Fam. Yeah, I think it's Pham Tien An. It's a debut film. And I think the kind of things you pick up about this on the grapevine before you see it is you're like, and I'm not just saying this because of the region of the world it's from, but it is picture pong for aesthetical coded.
Yes.
Film. You know, you also with these kind of with slow cinema, you're thinking of Simon Lang. You're thinking of Lav Diaz. You're thinking of a particular modality of filmmaking.
Thinking of Began as well.
Director
of Kylie Blues did spring to mind.
And also...
particularly the length of the camera. There were these shots that really sort of like got attached to things and then moved off. You know, he did try... I mean, should we just give the scenario? It's a very interesting scenario. It starts off at this kind of this bar where people are watching football. And then off screen, these three guys are sort of pontificating about God and faith
and simplicity and spirituality.
Exactly. Yeah. Having what I felt was quite a basic conversation, but it kind of, I was happy with the basicness at that stage because it was letting us in on the character. Off screen, which we then turn to slowly in a very interesting pan, is a crash between two mopeds in which we later learn there's been a fatality and some injuries. And then we learn that the people who were in this crash were actually related to one of the chaps.
The guy that's sitting on the left, Tien.
Yeah. It was actually his nephew and his sister.
Sister-in-law.
Who were in the crash. So then he has this journey to transport the body over to somewhere very far away where this woman's from. The sister-in-law.
His hometown, basically.
His hometown.
Yeah, in the mountains of Vietnam.
And then the rest of the film takes place not in the city, not in Saigon, but in the mountains. We mostly watch, so we watch him take the kid around, and then we, and
he, yeah, he's kind of, he becomes the ward for a short time of her son. The rest of the family, we understand, is migrated to America, and her former husband, who she separated from, has kind of absentee. Nobody really knows where he is.
So, but this guy, the uncle, has to basically, Tien, was also the name of the director, has to explain death and faith and various difficult sort of issues just to this child one-on-one. And then later on, the girlfriend of or the love interest of Tien kind of appears, and
she's now a nun,
and
she's realized her spiritual journey.
No, there's the nun. Yeah, yeah,
that's the same person.
Oh, and then
that's a flashback. Yeah,
flashback. Yeah. Okay, yeah, yeah. Okay. So really cotton on.
Yeah, it's a little bit. So it's a little bit. There's with this film, I think one of the interesting things about, I'm talking about someone else now, but Pitchfork vs. Ethical, is we're looking at a world in which the spirit world and the world of reality are intrinsically bound together. Mm-hmm. But much of the mise-en-scène of Vris Ethical is quite banal. It's plastic chairs sitting outside decking. It's people boiling rice. It's copper kettles. It's all this kind of ordinary stuff. And then you get these kind of slow emergences of the sublime, of the spirit world into the world of the living. I think with this film, it does that, and often does it to great... in a great register and great key and very powerfully, but maybe it does him a little bit too clumsily. So it shows us moments where, you know, he's going on a spiritual journey, basically. He meets various characters, some of whom might be real, some of who are ghosts, in the sense of he has this kind of flashback to this meeting with this girl before she became a nun and before he left for Saigon, where he looks like his age now, but she looks a bit younger. He meets a sort of Vietnam War veteran in this shack, and there's lots of these great these monologues.
This is maybe one of the longest shots. It goes to really various different locations and really drifts. Yeah, it's really nice.
There's an encounter with an old woman who's sort of got this soothsayery vibe about her. There's lots of moments where, as he's going on this journey, once he's kind of done the business of the funeral, and the funeral is like ethnographically really well captured. There's like a Highland Vietnamese funeral that's really well explored, and this kind of syncretic kind of mixture of like all this adaptation of Catholicism in this kind of particularly Vietnamese way. That's very cool. It slaps. It's really good. And then we get these kind of little suggestions that we're in this liminal space now. And, you know, there's lots of like Tarkovskian veils blowing in windows and the camera panning slowly outside, and color matching. And then there's lots of moments where Tien is suddenly being woken up rudely by someone. He's been asleep, and we're like, oh, is the scene we just saw a dream? Is
my
it real?
My worry is almost that it was at its best when it was being derivative. But I could feel a certain almost recognizable, you know, Tien and style coming through. But then I wondered whether it wasn't just reminding me of other directors that
he's like this kind of perfect smorgasbord in a way, because he's like, he, one thing Vris Ethical has is like, Vris Ethical isn't very interested in, I suppose, increasingly kind of youth culture, whereas we get a bit more of like young lads go to a kind of sexy spa where he gets a bit of a handy on the table. We get
just before we get there, this is so good, this bit
I love,
where
that,
he's
that,
had, you know, he's sort of this erotic masseuse thing happening, and then he gets an emergency phone call and he has to be reminded twice to actually check the phone, because obviously it's hugely important, relates to his sister-in-law, who we just sort of saw it before. That whole bit, that was all really going
well.
When
it was
well.
In Saigon, it was perfect.
Very exciting.
And then it kind of stumbled on its entry into the spirit world. It kind of tripped over the door, I think, over the door frame a little bit. And it was like, because everything was possible, it didn't really know what was permissible.
Yeah, and I felt like the spiritual element was mostly being communicated through rather sort of bold, but rather kind of obvious sound design fluctuations. I mean, there are amazing sort of bits where like it like rains and then stops raining, and then you see these like little butterflies or flies in the light. There are some shots that are totally magical and unimpeachable, you know, really. But yeah, I was clock watching a lot in the final hour. I just wasn't
there's a point where I thought, wow, I think I was like, yeah, I'm like, we must be there now. And I looked down, I was like, wow, we've got a whole hour left to go. Yeah. And I was like, it's the film doesn't...
We've all been there, guys.
Yeah, we've all been there. I think 2 hours in, the film doesn't really go anywhere more interesting. It just repeats this kind of, is it a dream? Is it real? Kind of narrative in a way that, you know, remember the best thing that someone like Vera Ethical does is with, say, Uncle Boon Mi, is when we get the emergence of the ghost at the table.
Yeah.
Like this great... And it's so tense, and it's really one of the greatest scenes of the 21st century on film. It's absolutely, yeah, absolutely unimpeachable, incredible moment of the interbleeding of the banal and the spiritual and the sublime. And here it's like, it's kind of like this pick and mix of, ooh, and here's another kind of cool sublime thing that I'm doing, and here's another one. It was a bit too much of a buffet of like significant, yeah, metaphorically significant moments. And I think they were all great. They were all like really, really beautifully shot, and they were really, really lovely, and there was real heart to all of them. Mm. Like, you know, but it didn't hang together really as like a coherent, you know, even if you go into the kind of strange labyrinth of the spirit world, it can still feel coherent. You know, I think about like the Taste of Green Papaya or whatever, like films like that.
Scent of the Green Papaya.
Scent of Green Papaya, which kind of can do stuff like this and have this kind of coherence even through incoherence. Or Simon Lang does it really well with Goodbye Dragon Inn, you know, this strange liminal space of this cinema.
Well, what it is
unfolding, and it feels
sensory,
weird, but part of a, it feels kind of like the architecture of the dream is coherent.
Part of achieving that sensory effect, I think, is a bit of refinement. You know, Goodbye Dragon Inn is a great thing to reference. In fact, lots of Simon Lang is good to reference because he's good at pulling back and isolating particular feelings and things. And actually, weirdly, I think some of these frames almost felt too busy, even though it was very slow and, you know, but it just didn't quite know what it was looking at. I think there's something beautiful about Vera Ethical, although I'm always have to admit in these conversations, I'm not as keen on Vera Ethical as most people whose opinion I respect are. I much prefer Simon Lang. But just to go to Tarkovsky, who's the second most kind of, or maybe the first most visible influence in this film, you know, I think what's great about Tarkovsky is he observes things in such a deliberate way, and he notices the thing that you want to look at in every scene and allows you to look at it. And it's not a thing that can really be put into words, you know. And it'll just be, and then he's bold enough, like all great artists, when something really works, he's bold enough to double down and do it really heavily. So like, you know, there's that scene in Mirror where like there's like a bit of condensation on a sort of a teak table, and it kind of evaporates in almost exact but not quite synchronicity with a kind of is it Ligeti or some kind of like orchestral, like sort of experimental orchestral climax, or you know, just all the moments where like a glass breaks and a bird comes out. You know, these moments that are very, very deliberate, and they always let us look at the thing we most want to look at. But they don't sort of ram our heads with it, but they know that that's what we want to see.
Yeah,
didn't get that in this film. It felt sometimes just a bit like, especially with the cinematography, which, because he was trying to do this elaborate thing where the camera was still and then moving again and still and following the characters, clearly too quite difficult to follow scenes. You could see that the frame was just being cropped in a bit sometimes in order to manage maybe extraneous things being in shot, or like a bit of camera shake that might have been corrected.
Yeah, it was good when it was
a bit clumsy, you know.
It was good when it was obviously it's you know, it's most controlled, like this opening scene where we have it's a scene of three thirds. We have this football game and this mascot who suddenly breaks away from the watch spectating the game to go and stop trying to hand out flyers or something. And that's when we're introduced to these three characters having this kind of lazy, like, I think the point is they're having a really kind of shallow conversation about spirituality because they haven't gone on this journey yet. You know, they don't really know what they're talking about, but they're kind of pontificating about the spirit world and about faith. And then the camera pans to this accident, and that so poised and good. And it tries to do it later with this kind of panning, and sometimes it felt a bit messy and unnecessary through the hospital ward and things like that. And it's so I think it was like, you know, there's a very famous anthropology book called Forest of Symbols about this society that is founded is ODing itself on symbology, basically. And so there's this sense where it was almost kind of going too hard. So we get, you know, where Tarkovsky will give us a bird, mm-hmm. we get a little chick, and then we get some ducks, and then mm-hmm. we got some roosters, and then we get another bird that flies in. Then we've got the funeral, and there's suddenly a bird that flies into the funeral, mm. And we get the bird, and he's like, okay, the bird's a symbol, I'm gonna keep doing it. So it kind of spams the copy and paste on some of these symbols a bit too much.
Very nice scene with some chickens, but I still don't quite like.
Yeah, it was just a bit too much.
It doesn't
much.
Have the raw sense of purpose that Tarkovsky's chicken mm. bit in Mirror has.
Yeah, so in my head, and one thing that was kind of spinning around in my head, it was like, and I didn't know if this was a deliberate strategy, is like for a long time, the moments that seemed keyed into being subliminal almost didn't reach that. It's like, are they failing intentionally as sublime moments, because everything's there to make you think that I'm seeing the face of God, but you weren't quite seeing it. And was it like, you know, in part of me, it was like in a generous reading, I was like, maybe he's making his point. You know, there's this scene which is a literal recreation of a scene from Solaris, when we see the river with the kind of reeds floating in it. And it's like, it's so overdetermined, that image, that it's got to be intentional, and he's not thinking, this is as good as Tarkovsky. He's thinking, I'm reminding you of another thing.
I hope it's not sort of Tarantino sample culture.
Yeah, I didn't recognize any of the shots in that film, really, though. I think that there was, and I kind of wondered if he was allowing these things to kind of fail just on the cusp of reaching there, because it's a guy who's on a journey. He's not completed the spiritual journey. And so I thought maybe that was a clever thing he's doing, where he's kind of allowing these scenes to fail on the cusp of sublimity almost. Mm. And he's actually not showing us the spirit world at all. He's showing us all these things that kind of shallowly in the world of the superficial gesture towards it. Because, you know, one of the things that, what is a film called Inside the Yellow Cocoon Shell? And when Tien Anh talks about the film, he said the cocoon shell is like a Vietnamese like idiom about like being trapped in the superficial world of sort of celebrity or being an influencer.
It's like a Matrix thing.
Yeah, or you might say like someone who's just obsessed with being an influencer in Saigon, right? It's like, you know, in the cocoon shell. Are we seeing the film from
within the sunken place?
In the sunken place, yeah. Are we seeing the whole film from within the cocoon shell? Someone who's trying to escape the world of banal appearance. And
it doesn't quite
actually
achieve that noble aim, because I'm very into, I mean, you know, like I think Petzold is quite good at, you know, In the Fire, for instance, at kind of looking at the feel of not to feel it, as a poet once said.
Yeah, he's really sparing the pencil. I think, yeah, I feel really generous and warm towards this film. I just feel like you said, you know, in the loos afterwards, you're like, yeah, his second film is going
to
bang. Like,
don't share the things that I said to you.
Sorry. You said, you know, don't scream. That was one thing you said. But I think I think he will probably refine this method. Whereas the funny thing is, he's kind of gone at it from the other end of the wedge, because when you look at someone like Verisethical starts off actually in a really mysterious object at noon, which is actually a really restrained, really restrained film, and Bill adds all the stuff, and you know.
Yeah, he plays with too many toys, I think, on his debut, but
he's got such a rich and recent heritage of slow cinema.
I think this film is struggling to get distribution, and I think it should be distributed, I wouldn't be, I wouldn't envy someone who was trying to get it into cinemas.
It's a hard sell to get this into Picture House, the 3-hour, quite contemplative film that's very beautiful and difficult.
But it won the Camera d'Or. It was, I think that there should be some law where the film that wins the award for camera can gets distributed in the UK
automatically
somehow. I don't know what mechanism. Maybe we need a planned economy.
I feel like this will show a like Curzon and maybe the ICA.
Well, it won't show if it doesn't get distribution. You know?
It must. It'll get distribution surely.
It might not.
It's a shame.
There's only like how many distributors, like Curzon doesn't really buy this kind of thing now, but Curzon doesn't just have.
I don't mean them being the distributor, but someone will distribute it. And screening at.
If Picture House haven't picked up, and then there's that thing, New Wave Films, they tend to pick up things. There's this thing, what's it called? The one that picked up Do Not Expect Too Much at the End of the World.
Oh, the Ratty Jude.
But there, but again, it doesn't quite fall into the right space.
It's not tied enough. The only way it would happen is if people make enough shouts about it being basically like for a pitch for a snack, which I don't think is reasonable.
And even our praise of it is not really fulsome enough to guarantee, not that we have that much influence, but you know, it's like, I don't think that many people are going to love it enough.
No,
to really get
I'm
it.
Glad
seen.
I'm glad it's well.
But that's fine. He'll make a better film, hopefully, and then that film will do well.
But I did really like it.
Yeah,
like, you know, of all the films I've seen so far, I think it was. Yeah, maybe maybe the most interesting. And I think Breyat was the most interesting, actually. I think this was the most kind of...
True, out of the films...
This one matched the idea I have of what a really good art house film could,
Out of the films we discussed, I guess I'm most impressed by this one. And, well, yeah, I did see Memory by Michel Franco, which I was quite keen on. So we'll discuss that...
Next time.
When George and Owen have seen it. But, yeah. Also the Breyat, good. But
good.
Flawed. Flawed but good is very much a theme, but I think so we're feeling quite positive and
well,
charitable.
Well, we've got Glazer, we've got Victoria Ricci's first film in like 800 years.
Yeah.
I think there's a lot of like big hitters that are about to land for
and
us
the
over
sweet
the next
Easter
2 weeks.
I'm going to be seeing tomorrow. So quite a lot to look forward to. We're going to talk about Michel Franco in more depth as well because of his new film, Memory. And that is going to do it for our first report from London Film Festival 2023.
Over and out. Thank you for watching and listening.
See you later.
Bye.